Welcome to another exciting episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. Today's special guest is Nadine Smith, an LGBT activist and the executive director of Equality Florida. Nadine has been recognized as a national leader by such organizations as the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, the Human Rights Campaign, the Human Rights Task Force of Florida, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the National Black Lesbian and Gay Leadership Forum. You went to high school in Panama City, Florida, a conservative area in the Florida Panhandle. What was that like for you, not only as a person of color, but also a member of the LGBT community?
Yeah, the Panhandle is very, very conservative. I remember taking I was on the basketball team we were driving through Port St. Joe. And I remember it was either the bus driver or the coach told us to slide down in our seats so they could not see our faces through the window if we were Black. They said, they'll shoot at the windows if they see your face. And it wasn't done as it was done in a matter of fact way that gave you the impression that that's just how things were. When I graduated from high school, there was still in the heart of Panama City, an area called, I think it was called 100 Acres of Modern Homes for Colored People. And it was just a collection of ramshackle housing. You literally had the train tracks that divided the city, and, racist slurs and homophobic slurs you would hear on a routine basis, not just from students, but also from teachers and coaches. So, my parents, my mother was from England, my father from Mississippi and then New York. My mother is biracial, but she was assumed to be white. And so therefore my parents could only be stationed. My father was in the Air Force at Air Force facilities that are in integrated states. And so, there's a long legacy of fighting racism in my family. And I was raised to, as my parents would say, never think you're better than anyone, but never let anyone think that they're better than you. And so they knew they were teaching a young, Black girl living in the South, how to stand up for herself. They just didn't know they were instilling those same messages and lessons in a young lesbian as well.
Now, being in that area, in the Panhandle area, when you started coming of age, what kind of impact did the local bar community have on your coming out process?
So growing up, long before I could legally go to any bar, everyone knew the Fiesta or the Club Royale, the Fiesta. It was the gay bar in downtown. And, it held a lot of the intrigue. If there was a rumor about a teacher being gay, someone would say that they saw them going into the Fiesta, because it was right in downtown. It was like, you could see the movie theater from there and, restaurants. So it wasn't, as is often the case, tucked away in an obscure part of town in the warehouse district. It was in the heart of downtown. And I know every time I had occasion to ride by the Fiesta, from the time I heard about it in middle school, I was always keeping my eyes open, always, hoping we drive by, hoping I catch a glimpse of somebody heading into the Fiesta. But it was a punchline to a joke that, you were in the Fiesta or something like that. And I think one year for a spirit mission, the football team, the task was to run into the bar and grab a book of matches to prove that you'd been in there. Anyhow, I remember the first time I went to the Fiesta, the first time I tried to go to the Fiesta, I parked like three buildings away, walked way, like through the back parking lot. And just as I got to where I had to go onto the front street, these high beam lights, just kind of flicked on out of nowhere. And I literally just dove to the ground. And then you know, scampered back to my car. The first time I actually went, I remember walking in and immediately seeing a neighbor of my grandparents, the son of one of my high school teachers. You know, it was just sort of, and they both freaked out, and they both freaked out, but I was like, hey, listen, we're all in here, right? So like, I'm not here on a spirit mission. I'm not going to out anybody. But the fiesta became, you know, it was the only place to go. So you got quite a cross section of people in there. We used to joke that it was the laziest drag show in America. You know, it's like the drag queens could hardly be bothered to throw on a slip, but you know, it was the only watering hole. So you met everybody there. You saw everybody there.
Yeah, and I've heard that from a lot of people around the country in different, you know, different gay bars and things like that, about how that impacted their coming out and everything. Was the gay community itself at all cohesive or supportive at that time in Panama City? Did you feel like you had a support group or a family there that you could depend on, or were they just other people that happened to be gay and you could have a drink without somebody telling the world?
Well, you know, that wasn't the first gay bar I went to. The first one I went to was in Pensacola. I want to say it was called the Red Rooster. And I was underage. And there was a bunch of us from the softball team who drove out to Pensacola. I think I told people I was going to Church Street. I think I told my family I was going to Church Street Station. I must not have been underage, but you know, I was in that last window where you could be 18 and then they changed it and you had to be 21.
Right.
So so friends younger than me couldn't legally drink. And so they ended up changing the age limit on bars, even though we were of legal drinking age, where it made it complicated to get into establishments when you were under 21. Anyway, the whole point to this is, I remember the Red Rooster, or no, Red Garter, that was it, the Red Garter. Okay, you know what? I'm going to have to start this over, because I remember I was underage the first time I went to the Red Garter, and here's how I know. We got there, and we had come up with this idea, me and a couple of high school friends, that we would say that we were students from the University of West Florida, you know, I guess to explain our youth. And we got there, we got in, no problem. And then I remember this woman, she starts talking to me, and I'm thinking, I have no game whatsoever. And I remember she asked me, after I said I was a student at University of West Florida, she asked me what I was studying. I remember just staring, like, we hadn't thought it all the way through to come up with majors or anything like that. I think I said math. But shortly, like moments after that, in came the naval, what is it, OSI, the police force for the Navy, came pouring in, and everyone who was in the military scattered. They started snapping photographs of people inside of the Red Garter. And it was only later that someone said, yeah, the military police will come in periodically and just sort of do that. It was terrifying. So yeah, I would say this, to me, the bar, you know, at that time of my life, it was both, you know, exciting because I wasn't, you know, it was like, I'm not alone. There are this whole range of people here. But it was also filled with, you know, all of this stress. So for me, that sense of family and connection and people you could count on and lean on came from, you know, the players on my softball team. You know, we were sort of a crew, you know, that kind of looked out for each other. And so we'd hang out a little bit at the fiesta when we were young, and then, you know, a little bit more. Then a bar opened up out on the beach that was, you know, but the fiesta was always the, you know, you always remember the fiesta.
So after you'd been to a couple of gay bars and you kind of discovered your community there, and you had your support from your teammates, and you'd experienced a military raid of sorts in a gay establishment. Then you decided to follow in your father's footsteps and go to the Air Force Academy. How was that as a gay woman?
Well, it was an interesting time because it was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You could just be kicked out for being gay. And in fact, two things were happening at the same time. There were a series of sexual assaults that were happening. The sexism directed towards female cadets was off the charts. But they were also doing these anti-gay witch hunts where, you know, you would just, not only were people being kicked out of the military, they were getting dishonorable discharges, and they were being, you know, sort of threatened with imprisonment if they didn't name names. And so, you know, you would just hear like five people got kicked out with dishonorable discharges. Now, just to add to the, they had this thing called the All Rights Inspection. And at night they would knock on your door and ask if you were all right for certain contraband. And one of them was, you know, whether you had food you weren't supposed to have or weapons you weren't supposed to have or drugs, any kind of contraband. And after a number of upperclass cadets had been kicked out for being gay, they began to do an all rights inspection sort of periodically on homosexuality. And at the academy, you also have the honor code. I will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate among us those who do. And so you could get kicked out for a lie, even if it was called what's called quibbling, not even if, you know, if I asked you, did you drink all the milk? And you say no, knowing that you drank the last of the milk, and that's really what I was asking, that would be called quibbling. But I remember I was getting an ulcer just from the stress of each knock, whether they were going to ask that question, because I had determined that I would tell the truth. And it was really making me physically ill. I came out at the academy to to two people. One was a counselor that you could go and talk to. A lot of people dealing with stress and being away from home for the first time, all those kinds of things. And also to an army guy who was teaching at the academy. He was just a really good guy and not caught up in a lot of the super macho stuff. He was probably the toughest man I've ever met. But it turned out that counselors don't keep your information confidential at the academy. And there came a point in time where he said, you know, you can wait for the knock on the door, or you can wait until that counselor shares what you've shared and receive a dishonorable discharge, or you can, you know, leave under your own steam and get an honorable discharge. And I chose the latter. But it was, you know, it was an interesting, I'm glad I went. I'm glad I left. I played on the rugby team, which the other teams that we played, I think sensing all of the internalized homophobia within the Air Force Academy female cadets would do cheers that were intended to, you know, shock and appall us. And I just thought, I think I'd like to party with that team. But anyhow, I was glad I went. I was glad I left. And shortly thereafter, well, not shortly, it's in 94 when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell was implemented. And I got to talk to some folks who were there at the academy during Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was, you know, they just said such a strange time of like even being more susceptible to being blackmailed in a sense. And then not too long ago, I talked to somebody who had gone to the Air Force Academy after the ban had lifted. And you know, there were a bunch of cadences that we did that were, you know, filled with homophobic slurs and sexist slurs. And I asked him about that. And he said, oh, those are all gone. They changed all of those lyrics. They don't do that anymore. So it's hard for me to fathom what, you know, I was there 83, 84. It's hard for me to fathom what it is you know, what that transformation was like.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's hard for a lot of the listeners who are younger to comprehend, you know, not only the type of experience that you had in high school, in the Florida Panhandle, in the Air Force Academy, but they just don't grasp what things were like back then. You know, they grew up in a completely different time frame where being gay is almost a non-issue on some levels in comparison to what, you know, you and I went through 40 years ago. There's a big difference.
Well, you know what? Yes and no, because I will say it this way. In the Panhandle, like, there's a GSA at my high school, which is sort of unfathomable to me to imagine going back in time and having a gay straight alliance. And especially as you know, a Black girl, you know, coming of age as a lesbian, all of the few images that existed were mostly gay men. And if there were lesbians, they tended to be sort of sinister characters. Gay men tended to be sort of the comic relief, the sidekick kind of, the lesbian characters were much more sinister. And I remember in elementary school, it must have been fifth grade, so or sixth grade at Patterson. I remember going to the card catalog. Now there's a blast from the past. And flipping through and looking up homosexuality, because I knew I was gay before I knew what the word for it was. In fact, in third grade, I tell people I had my first girlfriend in third grade, and I know that she was my girlfriend because she told me she was. And she also told our teacher that we were going to get married. And our teacher, who was, you know, when you have a teacher that's so much a favorite that, it's so much a favorite that you accidentally call them mom, or, you know, they just, so this was our, just my favorite teacher. And I remember she told me, and I used to say this girl's name. I used to say her full name when I was telling this story. And I remember the first time I heard Google, because someone asked me to spell her last name, which was a bit unusual, the spelling of her last name. I said, why do you need that? And they said, I'm going to Google her, which I thought, what? And I thought, no, I don't want to know that, you know, she's works for Sarah Palin or, you know, was killed tragically. You know, like I said, she's preserved in amber for me. She's perfect, you know, in that first blush of love as a kid. And so I took to calling her Amber. Anyway, so she told me and Amber to stay in the classroom. And then she told us, listen, you have to marry a boy. Girls can't marry girls and boys can't marry boys. You will have to marry a boy. Which I literally took to mean that I had to marry a boy, not that if I was going to get married, that was my only option. And that sort of, if I didn't pick one would be assigned to me. And so I remember we sat under this tree where we always had lunch together, and she was crying and I was furious. And I looked up, and I don't know what gaydar is, but I know I had it because I went up to the gayest little boy in our class. And I will, for these purposes, call him Art. I said, listen, Art, you and I are getting married and you're changing your last name to Smith. And then Amber is going to live with us when her husband gets killed in the war. So I was an organizer from early times. And so I had told that, you know, I told that as a way of saying, I remember knowing that I was gay. Like I never didn't know. I remember one time I told that story and somebody said to me, that's really so sad. And I said, what do you mean? Well, that your teacher that you cared about so much made you ashamed of who you are. And it really hit me how much that was true, how I glossed past the fact that it was really the first moment that I got the message that I wasn't supposed to exist. And that if I existed, I needed to hide. And if I didn't hide, that I would be, you know, shamed, humiliated, and maybe worse. And so it affected me in the sense that I never, you know, what was free and easy and open and just, you know, growing up suddenly became this secret. And so that was the part of me that was flipping through the card catalog, looking up homosexuality, because you know, I had all these messages about who gay people were, and none of them were positive. So I remember looking up this book And I flipped to the section that says homosexuality, see female, lesbian. And almost word for word, it was lesbians hate men. You know, they are aggressive and loud and angry. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't hate men. I love quite a few in my family, and most of my best buds are guys. So maybe I'm not gay after all. And then it said also see bisexuals. And then I flip over and I look at bisexual, and it says, you know, basically it's like bisexuals are sneaky. They can walk among us, you know, like Canadians, they, you know, you don't know until they steal your wife, that, you know. And I thought, oh my God, I might be a sneaky bisexual, you know? And so those were the resources available, you know, in Panama City, if you were a gay kid trying to figure out who you were. But the one thing I did know was, because back then, when you checked out a book, there was a little pocket, right? And in the pocket was a little card, and you would sign your name, and they'd stamp the date it was due, which meant you could see every single person who'd ever checked out that book. And I went to every book that had anything to do with homosexuality, and I looked at who checked that book out. And I was like, I knew it, which also meant I was never going to check one of those books out. And I remember, you know, tricking friends into, hey, would you mind checking this book out for me? I've got too many, and I got a book report. Oh, sure. So, you know, who knows what came of that for them, but that was the level of just sort of tension and fear. And, you know, and it's why, you know, oftentimes when you find somebody who's really homophobic, it is not surprising to discover that they're gay, because the message you get very early is, you know, not just hide, but like, you know, get people off the scent, you know, distract them. And the best way the go-to to hide the fact that you're gay is to be the biggest homophobe in the room. And that's why, you know, when healthy heterosexuals who were secure in their identity don't obsess about the lives of gay people. And so when you find these people who seem to wake up every day asking themselves how they can make gay people's lives an absolute misery, you just go, please go get some therapy and stop, you know, taking out your conflict on the rest of us.
I can absolutely relate to that, because, you know, I was kind of exploring my sexuality around the same time. We're roughly the same age. We went through the same type of experiences, except I was up in the New York City metropolitan area. But even still, there were the same types of reactions. And the information, of course, was the same. I remember one of the first books that I looked at that gave me some insight into what the societal view of homosexuality was, is a book that back in the day was kind of controversial. I believe it was called Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask.
Uh-huh.
In that book, it was a little paperback book, and in that book, there was a section on homosexuality. And I had had a couple of casual, we'll call them playmates, you know, high school buddies or whatever.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that that was like a lifestyle or an option long term. I thought this was like, you know, you have some friends you play tennis with, you have some friends you play cards with, you have a couple of guys that you have sexual encounters with, but it's not your long term plan. And I read this section in that book, and it basically said that most homosexual encounters involve two anonymous men in a bathroom or dark alley who exchange sexual favors and leave within 5 minutes, never knowing each other's name. And that was basically the way they encapsulated the experience. It wasn't, you know, something that you could be. You couldn't be a gay person. You
Right.
could be a sexual, anonymous sexual partner of someone of the same gender. And that was it. There was nothing else to it. And I later found out that was not the case. But so after you experienced this in Panama City, in the Florida Panhandle, and then through the Air Force Academy, and you left the Air Force Academy, you then came over to the West Coast of Florida and continued school in Tampa at USF. Is that correct?
It is. Well, I spent a little time in Panama City getting my AA transferred to USF on scholarship, and then I've stayed in the area ever since. I was a mass comms major, and you know, I got a job while I was still in college as a NPR at the NPR affiliate doing radio. And I had a big story that I had put together, and it implicated the USF Psychiatric Center for sort of dumping, what do they call it? Not pump and dump, but just sort of like using up people's insurance, keeping them as long as their insurance held up, and then tossing them out when it was no longer profitable. And WSF Radio wouldn't air that story. And I had won some awards for investigative journalism and different things. And so this really was a moment where I just thought, I can't work at a place if they're not going to have that integrity. And one of my former associates there had gotten a job at the Tampa Tribune. So I went to the Tampa Tribune, brought that story with me. We ran that story there, and then WSF aired the story and got an award for that story, for airing that story. Anyway, but that's how, you know, so journalism was the career that I sought. You know, I saw All the President's Men, you know, when I was in junior high school, and I'd loved that movie. I worked with the newspaper in my school. In fact, if you were to flip through my yearbooks and see what people scribbled, you know, it was all about me being, you know, a journalist. And then I was voted most likely to, you know, expose corruption and force a president to resign. So that was the path I was very, very much on. And then after the 1987 March on Washington, there was a lot more push for people to pass local human rights ordinances. Now, at this time, I was covering the city council in Tampa when a straight pastor from the Unitarian Church, I believe, Mike Young was his name, brought forward a proposal to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation. And he'd been put up to it by a local organization that I think was formed by Bill Cagle and Keith Roberts. I may be missing out, you know, one may have formed it, but that was sort of the local activist team at the time. But because I was a reporter and not necessarily out to the city council, they spoke pretty freely in front of me. And I got to hear all of their homophobic takes on why this wasn't going to pass. And as a reporter, you spend a lot of time writing about things, you know, getting all of these different perspectives and then explaining an issue in easily accessible language so people can understand exactly what's happening. But what you don't do is prescribe. You're not an activist. So you tell the story, you bring in the perspectives. And even if it's easy to connect the dots about what the solution ought to be, you avoid interjecting yourself. And so for me, it was very difficult, particularly on that issue, to be on the sidelines. And it was difficult on a range of issues where when you study something deeply and you have ideas, you want to be part of the solution, but you have to resist that as a reporter. And then finally, this was an issue that was so close to home. And I thought, I need to be on the other side of this equation. I need to be on the activist side of this equation. And that's how I got involved. I started writing press releases for the local group. That ordinance didn't pass at that time. It would be a few years later that we were able to pass it at the city level and at the county level, sort of breaking the stranglehold that Anita Bryant had on Florida, and sort of paving the way for a lot of local communities to take up passage of human rights ordinances.
So once you had been kind of rooted in Tampa, did you find the experience different than it was in the panhandle? Did you find it a little bit more open? I know there were still hurdles, there were still, you know, pockets, but did you felt like Tampa was a little bit more in alignment with your ideology and your lifestyle at that point?
Well, I mean, comparatively, I mean, I grew up in Callaway, which is tiny. Going to, you know, Panama City was the big city nearby. And, you know, there was no comparison. between Panama City and Tampa. You know, it was a college town. It was multiple colleges, lots more gay bars in college when I was in college at USF. You know, that was the most fun. That was the bar era. You know, all the Mahbone bars, and you go and play, go and play pool, and you know, drink beers and talk foolishness with friends. Those were my best bar years. A lot of fun. You know, on Dale Mabry, there was, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember. It was right next to a McDonald's. There was Renee's. There was.
Yeah, there are so many. There was Renee's, there was Moody's, there was Baxter's.
Those are mostly the guys' bars.
Yeah, Cityside and Jungle. I didn't know very many of the women's bars. And typically from my research, and I don't know if this has been the same experience you've had, because obviously with your position with Equality Florida, you would be more aware of bars. But from my experience, the women's bars were more under the radar, more discreet. They didn't advertise in the gay publications or anything for the most part. It was almost like a word of mouth thing. You almost had to know somebody to find out where they were, or look in a listing that wasn't a paid advertisement, because the women's bars didn't typically, you know, like Renee's was not a woman's bar. It was a huge bar that women went to as well as men. But, you know, all the big bars, Pleasure Dome, Trax, El Goya, all of those bars tended to be predominantly male. And the women's bars, from my experience in any city I've visited, have tended to be a little bit more under the radar and off the beaten path. Or
like Paradise was down in, you know, in Suitcase City near USF. And, it was definitely not Paradise. I think the few times I went there, like a bar fight would always break out. Usually because a straight guy had walked in and was getting inappropriate. But Paradise and the other one had a package store out front. But that was our favorite. But yeah, that was the highlight years. Those were the magic years of being of age, out in a fairly big city, and having a social network, and that sense of a bar being an oasis away from all of the noise, all of the haters, you know, all of that. It was definitely that oasis, that safe place to be yourself, and to be away from the, you know, the judgmental crowds. And, you know, it was a room of our own.
Now, over the years, obviously, you'd worked in journalism and you had been unable to express your activism side. How did the Equality Florida situation arise? I know you've been the executive director of Equality Florida for almost 25 years. I mean, it's hard to believe that, but as long as they've been around, you've been around in that capacity. Yeah. How did that evolve out of your journalism career and your presence in Tampa?
Well, you know, I think I said I started helping to write press releases. This was also in the window of time when the organizing for the 93 March on Washington was happening, meaning there were local organizing committee meetings, and I was elected to represent our area at a regional meeting in Orlando, and then elected there to represent at a state meeting in Miami. And four of us from Miami were elected to represent the state in California. There was a meeting in Los Angeles, I believe. And there I was elected to be one of the four co-chairs of the march. And so this was in probably 91, heading into 92. And then the march was scheduled for April of 93. And so you know, I threw myself fully into organizing at that point. And at the same time, the local work, you know, that human rights ordinance had been rejected that was brought forward by the minister. But, and I think then it was called the Bay Area Human Rights Consortium was the local group. And that evolved. And all of this is happening against, you know, all lots of complications, like women and men working together was not an easy thing. There was a lot of, you know, sexism and tension and you know, we didn't hang out together. We didn't go to the same bars together. But those of us who were doing work with ACT UP around AIDS and HIV were sort of forging this bond that, you know, sort of transformed the way men and women were working together around LGBT issues beyond HIV. And from that sort of nucleus, we became the Hillsborough Human Rights Task Force. You know, all volunteers. And we pushed for the passage of a local human rights ordinance. And we did a lot of organizing. And in fact, if you look at the people who were part of that first push for a human rights ordinance in Tampa, you see the founders of Pride and you see the founders of the Gay Men's Chorus and the LGBT Chamber, you know, like all of this cultural, the film festival, sort of this cultural renaissance that happened in Tampa was rooted in that core team that came together to secure these protections in a state that had been so defined by Anita Bryant. And so, you know, eventually, because we were eventually successful in the passage of a city and a county ordinance, other places, Gainesville, Miami, everyone was coming to us and saying, you know, share what you know, share what you learned. You know, here are the talking points they're using. Here's the counter arguments. Here's the mailers we did. And soon we started to see that snowball. But the other thing that we realized was that while we were doing this local work, they were passing terrible bills in Tallahassee. They passed the marriage ban in Tallahassee. And those of us who were part of the Hillsborough Human Rights Task Force said, we will never let there be a legislative session where we're not there, where we don't have to just rely on the kindness of strangers to alert us of these terrible things happening in Tallahassee, where we have less than 48 hours to get to the panhandle and testify. And so we became the Human Rights Task Force of Florida. And we created that, you know, sort of that pledge that we would hold elected officials who came to us for our vote, we would hold them accountable to what they did in Tallahassee. But it wasn't until, so we were the Human Rights Task Force of Florida for a while, which was a great name if you wanted people to send their donations to the Human Rights Campaign or the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. It was a terrible name if you wanted people to understand we weren't a chapter of either of those fine organizations. So it was in 97 that we said we need to be not just a political committee, which was what the Human Rights Task Force of Florida was, but we needed to have an educational nonprofit arm because that was the lion's share of what we needed to do. And so in 1997, we formed as Equality Florida. That's when we fully became Equality Florida.
I remember those days well. I met you not long after that. And I was writing for Watermark in Orlando, writing their Tampa column. And we shared office space in a little tiny building on Cleveland over there.
Yes.
In kind of the NoHo area of mm-hmm. Tampa. And of course, the organization has come an incredible way. I mean, since 1997, you know, yeah. At that time, I think you were probably running on a skeleton staff. There wasn't, you know, a whole huge presence. There were probably mm-hmm. a lot of people in the gay and lesbian community who were unaware of the existence or the mission of Equality Florida. And now it's totally different. I see people that you work with everywhere. You know,
yeah.
they're
I remember those days. Stratton and I would take off in opposite directions and just travel the state, and we would go, you know, we were like, I don't know, like roving pastors. We would go anywhere that a few people would gather. We would go meet with them and say, this is what we're up to. You know, this is what we're doing. You know, people would invite us to come speak, and it turned out it would be at a bar in, you know, some small town in the panhandle. And you'd go, you'd get them to cut off the music for just a few minutes so you could speak. And of course, everyone loves being at a bar when they cut off the music for a political talk. But anyway, we would, if you invited us, we would go. And that's how we slowly began to build this network. And I remember it was our big goal to go to every Pride. And we thought, you know, and in 10 years, we'll have 10,000 names of people that care about this. You know, and now we're talking about moving millions of voters in election cycles. So it has been an incredible, it's just been an incredible time, you know, to be in the South doing this work, to be doing it in the third most populous state in the country, in a state that is the 17th largest economy in the world. You know, what happens in Florida has such an outsized influence far beyond the borders of our state. So doing this work has been, you know, certainly about changing the place that is my home, but it's also been about changing the story of what's possible outside of those dark blue states. You know, it's not all about, you know, California and New York and Massachusetts. It's about making change in the places so that we don't have to leave home, that we can live where we're from, and we can, you know, make it better for the generation behind us.
Absolutely. And I was going to mention that you said, you know, in the third largest state in the country, but also the only one of the quote mega states that's really in the deep South. I mean, the rest of them, like you mentioned, you've got, you know, New York, you've got California, Texas isn't, you know, Southwest, but Florida is really the only one that's completely surrounded by blue states. I mean, by red states. You know, you've got of course, Georgia kind of fixed that this last time, and we love the people in Georgia for that.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think what people have come to realize more and more is that the South is not red. It is suppressed. The vote has been suppressed.
So we were talking about, you know, the evolution of Equality Florida into its current branding and focus. And I was kind of wondering, you were saying that there were a lot of people involved in the, we'll call it activism movement back at that time, who have gone on to organize and found other organizations that are kind of critical to our community here in Tampa. Did you find the same kind of support from the bar community? Were they always in alignment with, you know, from 97 on, once Equality Florida kind of came to be, were the bar owners and managers and people in that community supportive of what Equality Florida was doing? Did they play a role in the way Equality Florida evolved?
Bars were our go-to for outreach. They were our go-to for fundraising. Drag queens were among the biggest donors to Equality Florida in the early days. They'd host events and donate their tips. They really were phenomenal, and they were, you know, big personalities, and they would, you know, bring the community together. So, you know, this was at a time when it was hard to get people to join our board because they had to put their full legal name on the paperwork. You know, when we would have meetings at the old MC Film Fest building, and before that Tomes and Treasures, you would sit on this side of the room if you were willing to have the back of your head photographed, you know, if a reporter was there, and you sat on that side of the room if you didn't want the back of your head photographed, if a reporter showed up. And so it's just you know, under those circumstances, you know, we relied heavily on the bars. And, you know, there were some that they weren't really about the community, they were about the community's money, but mostly the bars were the early fundraising engines. If I had a roster of all the events we had, almost all of them were happening in the bars, you know, or at Pride. And so, yeah, the bars play a huge role in the early days of funding and being the place where we could network and connect with people. You know, we would register voters at the bars. We would, we'd sell our little hats or mugs or whatever we had at a little table. And we would stop the music to remind people to go vote. I remember one time we were canvassing to put out literature on, you know, our voter's guide. And I remember throwing a blanket over my head and going into the bathhouse and handing out information to make sure people understood that the election was coming and they needed to vote. So not sure a whole lot of women have ever entered that building, you know, ever entered that building back then.
I'm sure that's true. Now, Tampa has kind of an unusual situation that a lot of people may not be aware of. Basically, from the time that you came to Tampa until the present day, our local administration, the mayor of Tampa, has always been a Democrat. We have never had a Republican mayor since the mid-80s. And out of those mayors...
Was Greco...
Yeah, he was listed as a Democrat.
Surprises. I forget that sometimes.
But in addition to that, three of the five mayors we've had since you've been here have been women.
Yeah.
How did that impact your mindset when you come to a new city like Tampa? You have a mayor, I think at the time it was probably Sandra Freeman.
It was Sandy Freeman, yes.
And she was supportive of equality and you know, women's rights and all those kind of things. A couple of administrations later, we had Pam Iorio, who was also a very strong advocate and involved in a number of nonprofit organizations. And of course, currently we have Jane Castor, who must be the crown jewel in, you know, the mayoral race of the world. I mean, how much more pleased could you be to have a Tampa native, an athlete like yourself, a former police chief, the first, I believe, female police chief in the city of Tampa, and an openly lesbian mayor in the city where you basically started your political career?
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember the first time I met Sandy Freeman, it was when they were knocking down crack houses. She had this big initiative to knock down all these abandoned houses. And I went, you know, I was covering politics and I went out to cover this story and something had happened. She had worked the controls for just a couple of minutes, you know, for the photo op, had gotten out. And then the actual construction worker who really worked the machinery somehow injured himself, I think broke his leg or something. But I remember she was smoking two cigarettes at the same time. Like she had lit a cigarette, we had gotten so nervous and lit a second one, and she had two cigarettes in her hand. And she said, "Don't put that in the story." But Sandy was great. She was really supportive. She, you know, her team around her, Bob Buckhorn worked for her at that time, who of course later became mayor. And Pam Iorio had been a champion when she was on, you know, the county commission. She'd been a real ally. So, you know, at each phase, we were dealing with a city and a city council that was much better than the county commission.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So it has, you know, and Hillsborough, of course, distinguished itself in a negative way by having Rhonda Storms and her Pride Band, which really became an international story that so began to define Tampa.
Yeah.
That I think it incentivized Tampa to do more things to differentiate itself from its more backward county. And so that was helpful to us as well, to have a city that was like, yeah, let's figure out how we do this. Let's figure out how we put this message out. Let's invest in tourism dollars. And so every time they come at us, whether it's marriage equality or this anti-trans youth sports ban, they are also giving us a platform to educate people. And the truth is most people form their opinions you know, the way that all of us do. I didn't know gay people. So I believed whatever anybody told me about gay people. And then because I knew I wasn't a person who was, you know, a man-hating hater of this and, you know, all of the things, all these things that they said gay people were, it's like, well, I'm not that. So I guess either I can't be gay or they're wrong. And I was definitely gay. So I figured out they were wrong. But when you don't know, when you don't have any real world experience to contrast with what people around you are saying, you buy hook, line, and sinker. And so sometimes when the far right comes at us, what they really do is provide us a platform to debunk the lies that animate their arguments. And then you really, you know, sometimes it just takes one person. Because if you think, oh, well, I remember the first time I met an atheist, I can't even tell you where I got my ideas about what atheists are or are like or were. But I remember when, you know, in college, and this guy said, oh, yeah, I don't believe in God. And I thought, what? I mean, this was a super ethical dude, just very engaged, very compassionate, you know, one of the most generous people. And I couldn't tell you that somebody sat me down at some point in time and told me that atheists are this, this, and this. But I had gathered it from all of the context clues of my life that I should have a negative opinion. And this one person flew in the face of all of that. And immediately it's like, okay, well, that was garbage. Whoever taught me that, that was a lie.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes about atheism is when they say that, you know, as an atheist would say, well, I only believe in one God less than you do.
Exactly.
And that's really true. I mean, if you think about it that way, you know, you have a God that you believe in, but you don't believe in all of the other gods that all these other religions yeah. believe in. So why
yeah,
is it so
worshiping Thor or Poseidon
or, you know, Muhammad or whoever. So it's it gives you a different perspective. And I guess when you're an investigative journalist and you have an analytical mind, you kind of evolve those opinions a little bit differently than maybe some of the sheep who will just read one headline and that's it. You know, it's the gospel truth. But
well, yeah. And I think until you run into something, you know, we all get in our bubbles. I used to think that we should have national what if I'm wrong day, where you take your most basic assumptions and you ask yourself, okay, but what if I'm wrong? And if I'm wrong, you know, just evaluate what harm has been done. What is it imposing on somebody else? Right. And because that to me is much more fundamentally the question. Like I can be wrong about things, but if the only person that can be negatively impacted by my wrongness is me, it's different. Right.
Right.
But if I say, you know, people from Louisiana should not be permitted to drive in Florida. I think they're bad drivers, you know, and whatever. That's just not my opinion impacting me. That's my opinion right. taking things away from people. And so I do try to, you know, ask myself, you know, it's like the death penalty. You go, you know, if you support the death penalty, you might say, okay, but what if I'm wrong? If I'm wrong, innocent people are being put to death. If I'm wrong, race and class have more to do with whether you're put to death than guilt or innocence. You know, and so you can go, you know what? I don't know whether I'm wrong, but the cost of me being wrong is too high. Other people have to pay that price.
Right. So over the last 30 years or so, obviously the gay community, not only here in Florida, but across the world, has changed quite a bit. What kind of role do you feel like Equality Florida and other activism groups have made on the way we live our lives now compared to when you first came to Tampa?
You know, I used to do this exercise. I had been in a workshop where they did this exercise and I thought it was really powerful. And I think the first chance I got to do it was with a gathering that was mostly older gay men. And, you know, maybe there were 50 or 60 people in the room. And I said, close your eyes and imagine being born into a world where from the day you were born, you were affirmed for exactly who you are. And by that, I mean, you never had an aunt, you know, when you were 5 or 6, ask you if you had a girlfriend without, you know, wondering if you had a boyfriend. If when you fell in love, you had no fear whatsoever of telling anybody, and you knew they would be thrilled and eager to meet him. If, and, you know, like every stage of your life, imagine walking through the halls of your high school, holding the hand of your boyfriend, just, you know, and so I took them through every stage. And when it was over, it lasts like a minute and a half. And we all, you know, opened our eyes. There were like 8 guys on the front row, tears just streaming down their faces. And I thought they must have had a really powerful visual, you know, that, you know, and I just said, you know, would you mind sharing what you, you know, what that exercise meant to you? And each one of them said their tears were because they couldn't do it, that they just, it, you know, it wasn't just that it wasn't their experience, but they couldn't even imagine it to live in a world where they were affirmed from day one, where they never had to hide or lie or switch pronouns or, you know. And so I grew up in a generation, but, you know, sort of where we saw more possibilities. We grew up with gay images on television that were not all negative. We came of age when, you know, the movies might not have been very good, but they were at least attempting to be honest about our existence. And then, but I know that I feel limited in what I can even imagine, you know, my world being. And so I think each generation sort of resets what that possibility is. And I feel as though we now have a generation, like your coming out story used to be the coin of the realm. It's how you introduced yourself. It's sort of like the starting point for all of the conversations and getting to know somebody. And there are now, you know, multiple generations who don't really fully have a concept of coming out because they never were in. And it's as weird as asking heterosexual friends when they came out as straight. They would just sort of be like, what do you mean? When Equality Florida started, I don't think Jane Castor was out in her career. And, you know, we're now in a place where she ran as an out lesbian for the, you know, mayorship of one of the largest cities in the state. And, you know, not only did she won by a wide margin, and her sexual orientation was hardly a factor.
Yeah, you know? I was impressed. I've known Jane for a long time. And, when I saw that there were 7 candidates for mayor on the ballot, I knew that there would be no clear winner, because in Tampa, you've got to get 50% plus one. And when you divide that among 7 candidates, that's virtually impossible for any candidate to do. And yet she came in with something like 45% of the vote. So she was very close at that point. And then, of course, in the runoff, she just, I think, took the election by what, 3-1 margin or something. She was,
Was
way ahead of Strauss.
And the same was true in St. Petersburg, where Rick Baker was expected not only to win, but to walk away with 51% of the vote, or, you know, 50 plus one votes in the primary, which, you know, is somewhat unheard of. And we, you know, just absolutely dug in. And because Rick Baker had a horrible record on LGBT issues, had been his entire tenure as mayor had been marked by his utter contempt for our community, his taking every opportunity to disrespect us, you know, refusing, you know, even the most basic ceremonial acknowledgement of pride, even though it was pumping millions of dollars into the economy, just out of his way to be contemptuous. And so it is with great pride that I, you know, look at that last mayoral race and know that it was our community and our allies that absolutely, that the story of Rick Baker's homophobia and his anti-LGBT tenure as mayor is what did him in. There were lots of other folks who pushed him over the line, but it was that issue where the bright line distinction between him and Rick Kreisman began to not let him, you know, sugarcoat his previous administration's record, and, you know, more aligned him with Trump while he was trying to distance himself from the more conservative parts of his history. His record on LGBT issues made that impossible. So we are living in a time where being wrong on these issues can hurt you as a candidate, frankly, in both parties, depending on where you're situated. And at a time when there's a growing majority that doesn't even understand why we're having to have these fights, why we're having to go to Tallahassee and say, let the kids play when it comes to trans youth in schools. Let the existing guidelines, not your meddling for political purposes, continue to guide that process. And so I think that has been our legacy, that we have worked really hard on the local level and held the folks in Tallahassee accountable. And in recent years, we're doing more on the federal level as well.
Well, we certainly appreciate the decades of commitment you've had to Equality Florida and to gay rights in the state of Florida and throughout the country. What is your vision for the future?
My vision for the future is the vision that those men could not lock onto, that that we will continue to make it possible to be, you know, for kids born into this world to never have to experience the erasure, the shaming, the humiliations that many of us had to endure to be ourselves, where we will see ourselves reflected in, you know, in the general culture, you know, where the idea of a, you know, a lesbian president or a, you know, that there's no door that feels closed to us because of who we are. And, you know, I was saying to somebody that it's a strange sort of hive mind that occurs sometimes when I asked somebody not too long ago, where do you feel comfortable holding hands, whether you're in Tampa or whether you're in St. Petersburg with somebody that you, you know, you're dating or your spouse, or your partner. And everybody basically described the same sort of, you know, along this part of Central, along this part of, you know, Beach Drive, out this far this way, out that far that way. And I thought, you know, that's roughly the same thing that everybody says. And how do we know that? How do we transmit that information to each other? Nobody drew a map and said, yeah, you and Andrew will be fine holding hands here. It gets a little sketchy over here. Definitely avoid over there.
And as I mentioned earlier, we are very grateful for the decades of service that you have provided to make our community a better place, and for the time that you've taken today to talk to us about it and your experiences coming out in the gay community. Is there anything else you would like to add?
You know, I just want to, you know, just give one more shout out, because we wouldn't be here. We would not exist had it not been for folks who invested in an idea that seemed pretty preposterous back then, that we would, you know, change Tallahassee, that we would roll across the state passing, you know, non-discrimination ordinances, that the folks who invested in that idea way back then were bar owners, were bar patrons, were drag queens, you know, when we were running on a lot of ideas, a lot of caffeine and a few dollars, it was the bar community that kept the lights on for us. So I think it's important that people remember that, because it has always been the place where we first come out, where we first find each other, where we, you know, where we learn, and it has always been such a safe haven. And so it's why Pulse was so devastating, not just here in Florida, but nationwide and around the world, because it was such a violation of the sanctity of one of those rare oases that where we could be ourselves.
And that concludes another segment of the Gay Bar Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.